My name is Eileen McIntyre. I am today, my birthday, 66 years old. Today is November 25th, 2015, and I'm speaking with my sister-in-law, Anne O'Keefe. We are recording this in Hawaii, where we are together on vacation. What inspired me to interview Anne is that I am impressed by the women who went before me to get advanced degrees, and in Anne's case, she has her PhD, but she was in school in the 1950s, well before women's lib and all of that, and so I wanted to find out a little bit more about that. So thank you, Anne, for agreeing to participate with me today. Maybe we could begin by how you began to think about college. What inspired you to go to college, and how did you decide where you wanted to go to school?
Okay, but first, Eileen, I have to tell you happy birthday. Happy birthday. Okay. It was always assumed that we would go to college. It was never anything but that. I was born and raised in the Midwest. Always that was the plan, and our parents told, there were four of us, told us from an early age, we have saved enough money for you to go to our local wonderful university, Washington University, and anything that you do other than that would be on your own, but there will be enough money for you to go to Washington University and live at home. So it was just a given.
And yet you didn't go to Washington University, so how did you make a choice?
Well, of course, I didn't want to live at home. So I did apply for scholarships, and I got one to Grinnell, which I thought was wonderful. It was a co-ed college. But meanwhile, I had a girlfriend my age, Adele McVeigh, whose mother was a graduate of Bryn Mawr College. I had never heard of Bryn Mawr College, and I probably had said at one point that I would never be caught dead going to a woman's college. I mean, it never entered my mind. But Adele's mother, from the time I was 10 years old, told me, you need to go to Bryn Mawr. You need to go to Bryn Mawr. Well, of course, financially, it was out of the question. But I think through her encouraging, I did apply for a scholarship, and I got a full-ride scholarship. It was so much. It not only paid room and board, but a little bit for spending money, just amazing. So meanwhile, I had been accepted at Grinnell, and so we assumed that we would lose the deposit money to Grinnell. But when they heard that I had received this scholarship to Bryn Mawr, they wrote back this lovely letter returning the deposit and saying, we're so happy and pleased for you that you've been accepted to Bryn Mawr. It makes us feel good. It was just amazing. Wow. And the next year, my friend, the mother, her daughter, who was at this point a year behind me, she went to Bryn Mawr too.
Wonderful. So you were saying that you may have at some time thought that going to an all-women's college was not your cup of tea.
Absolutely not my cup of tea.
So after a couple of months, you were first, I guess you first went home at Christmas time, you were telling me earlier.
Yeah, Christmas time.
So how were you describing your college experience at that time? Do you recall?
Well, I loved it, but I'm 80 years old now, and as the years pass, I think sometimes we fog up, because I remember when I got home at Christmas time, I must have been homesick, because I'm remembering something that after the first meal at home, I couldn't get out of the kitchen washing the dishes, and my mother finally saying, Anne, come here and visit with us. But I think it was a homesick thing. I just wanted to be in the kitchen. I wanted to do familiar things. But I don't remember having any difficulty adjusting to Bryn Mawr. I remember once it was decided I was going, I was all for it. The whole business, it was a big deal in our family. Buying clothes, what clothes would a girl need to go to Bryn Mawr? We did a lot of catalog shopping. It was a very big deal. They assigned rooms, and at Bryn Mawr at that time, this was 1952, at that time, almost everybody had a single room. So I was assigned a room, and within minutes, I had made friends with people, and there was one classmate whose mother was there. This was very unusual. This woman, girl, was from Philadelphia. And I did feel later that the further away you lived from Philadelphia, Bryn Mawr being near Philadelphia, that the further away you lived, the better your chances of getting in. So the fact that this girl, Amy, was from Philadelphia immediately made me feel she must be a genius, because thousands of girls would be applying from Philadelphia. But her mother kind of took us all under her wing and became kind of the dorm mother. I don't remember any problems adjusting, but I do remember that episode going home at Christmas and being so happy to be home that I was happy to wash the dishes, scrub the stove, screen, just everything.
So. Wonderful. So here you were, pretty happy, well-adjusted at Bryn Mawr. When do you think you started to think about what you might do after college?
Well, actually, I had very fixed ideas when I entered Bryn Mawr, and they turned out all to be wrong. I was, from the early time that I can remember, I had thought I would be a physician. So I had absolutely no realistic expectations of how hard Bryn Mawr would be. That's probably the understatement of the century. So I loaded up against all their advice. You know, they give you a counselor, and I think I loaded up with five hard courses. I'm not saying that I failed any of them, but I certainly dropped one, and I didn't do very well. And I also realized that this was not the science, the chemistry, the biology was not going to be my thing. And that was a hard adjustment to make, because all my life I had thought I would wind up going to medical school. So it was in, I think, my sophomore year that I decided I needed to change a major. And I chose psychology because, and I took my first psychology course in my sophomore year. I chose it for the odd reason that if you majored in Bryn Mawr at psychology, you had many more electives that were available to you. If you majored in, say, pre-med or chemistry or biology, you were loaded with all science courses. And I wanted to get the broadest liberal arts education, but I didn't have any real idea. I knew that I didn't want to teach. And, of course, I became a teacher at some point later. Everything that I was never going to do, I wound up doing at some point.
And when did you decide that postgraduate study was in order for you?
After I graduated from college, and I did not do well, most of my friends graduated cum laude or magna cum laude. I did not. I barely graduated. Well, that's probably an overstatement, but I did not do well. As a matter of fact, so much so, and this is a statement about Bryn Mawr that has stayed with me for my entire life, I had assumed I would lose my scholarship because my grades were not doing well. And so I went to talk to them about it, you know, because I thought, now that would really be humiliating and embarrassing. But what they said was, once we've made a decision on somebody, we know there was a reason for making that decision. And if you stick with us, we'll stick with you. And that's the way that it was. And I do think that in the back of my mind, all these years have been kind of the thought of doing right by them for, you know, sticking with me that way. But when I did okay in psychology, so that was good. And I liked it. And I liked the professors. But when I finished college, I had no intention of going back home. I really wanted to live in Washington, D.C., although I didn't really know anybody in Washington, D.C. As it happens, in my senior year, I had gone to an Eastern Psychological Association meeting and had met a man who was about 10 years older than I, and eventually we married. But and he lived on the East Coast. But when I graduated from college, I was just glamour-struck by the idea of Washington, D.C. And so my parents, my family came to the graduation. We lived in St. Louis, and this was a big deal. I assume they drove. They didn't fly. I went home, and I was home for 3 weeks, packed my bags again, took a Greyhound bus back to Washington, lived in a YWCA, found a roommate, got a job, and if you ask me how I put my Bryn Mawr degree to work, I was an answering machine operator in order to pay the bills. And that's what I did. And while I was thinking about what did I want to do. However, at this time, there was a presidential election going on, and I volunteered for Adlai Stevenson as, would you believe, since I was now a seasoned telephone operating person, I was in big demand in his office to answer the telephone, so that was a lot of fun. One thing can lead to another. But I did get married, and graduated, I guess, in May of 1956, and by December of 1956, I got married, moved back east, and took a teaching job, having said, of course, that I would never teach. But
so you were an operator during the summer and fall?
Yes, until October.
And then you moved from Washington, D.C.?
Well, came back home to St. Louis to get married.
Okay.
Then moved back. My husband worked at the Edgewood Arsenal near Aberdeen Proving Ground. It's called Edgewood Arsenal, 30 miles from Baltimore. So we lived in that area in a town called Bel Air. And he was insistent that whatever job I get would be somehow appropriate to his standing. He was a PhD psychologist himself in human factors engineering, and so we decided that teaching would be an acceptable job. So I did 3 years of teaching while married to him. I taught fifth grade for 1 year, and then 2 years of special education. Of course, I had no training for any of these things, so I began a pattern in my life, which was training myself. For example, when I saw that I was going to teach special education, I mean severely mentally retarded children about whom I knew very little, I went to institutions, I went to other schools, I just immersed myself in that field and reading and talking with people so that I could equip myself for that. But then, because I didn't have a teaching degree, of course, I was on a temporary teaching thing, and so I started working for a master's in education, which I then got from the University of Maryland, an MA. Eventually, my doctorate was an EDD, a Doctor of Education, but it's in the psychology. I've been a member of the American Psychological Association since 1965, but technically, my doctorate is in education. But I only taught, actually, for the 3 years.
So just to change the topic a little bit, so you mentioned getting married in 1956,
mm-hmm.
And you got a job teaching. You have two sons. At what point did you have your sons?
My first son was born in 1961, and that was about the time that my husband, Earl Davey, left the government and took a job with a human factors engineering outfit in Los Angeles. And therefore, we all drove to Los Angeles. And I had just gotten my Master of Arts. As a matter of fact, this is kind of a cute memory. I was 3 weeks from delivery when I did my oral exams for the Master of Arts, and people were hoping that nothing would happen during... Oh, it turned out I had been told that the oral exam would be about an hour, and it turned out to be about 3 hours, and that's because I had done an unusual topic. I had gotten very interested in the area of reading and why it is that children have difficulty reading, and I had worked with another psychologist on organizing approaches to teaching reading to people for whom that would be difficult. So for my master's thesis, I taught somebody to read whom everybody had said would never learn to read. And then I brought that person to the oral thesis, and it was very unusual. And it was acknowledged as being unusual and fascinating. And I did not have the baby during that 3 hours, which was very nice. Then we moved to California. And unfortunately, when we got to California, I began to realize that this was not a marriage that was made in heaven, but there I was with a baby who was not quite 1 year old. But I found a job at the UCLA psychology clinic. I went to apply to teach there. So I went to teach at the psychology clinic school, which specialized in teaching boys who were having learning disabilities. And I had found childcare, done everything. But when I went to interview for the job, the head of the school, who was a psychologist named James Coleman, and was the author of, I learned later, it's called Abnormal Psychology in Modern Life, which is published by Scott Forsman, outsold all other abnormal psychology textbooks combined. He was the head of the psychology clinic school, and when he interviewed me, he said, well, I don't really want you teaching. I'd like you to be my research assistant because I'm revising the book, and I need somebody, and with your background, will you do that? And I said, of course, yes. So I was there about a year, and then another opportunity just kind of came to me out of the blue that was a very hard decision to make, and that is that the psychologist, his name was Myron Woolman, that had really been a mentor to me and was a good friend of my husband's, got a major grant from the National Institute of Health, and it was all staffed. He was going to be the principal investigator, and he had somebody else with a PhD who was going to work on it. Well, that person bowed out at the last minute. So Myron Woolman flew to Los Angeles and asked me if I would come and take that job.
So this would mean moving across the country?
Moving across the country with my not 1-year-old child, leaving my husband. It was leaving the father, the child. I mean, it was very, very, very hard to do. But Myron Woolman didn't think he could get anybody else, because the nature of the research grant that he had, or the study grant that he had, was unique and required somebody who was already familiar with his very unusual programming strategies. And even though I didn't have a doctorate, which one would normally have for that position, anyhow, it all worked out, and I made the decision, and it was a big wrenching thing, but I did. And that's how I got back to Washington, D.C., and really spent the next 40 or 50 years in Washington.
And so during this time, you're a single parent?
Mm-hmm.
And how did you find the challenges associated with that, doing what sounds like very important research and being a mom to yourself?
Well, I just did it. And, you know, I'm sure that I must have thought of these things as challenges, but it is amazing how I just, whatever had to be done, I just did it, and I just did it. But I was lucky to get childcare, interviewing people and getting childcare. I always made it my business to live near where I worked so that it would be close, and I kind of set up what has to happen to make whatever it is work. I paid my childcare people very well, so that it was a good place to work. And that job early on did not require travel. Later on, I had jobs that required extensive travel, but my children were a little bit older. But I did meet somebody in Washington and remarried and had another child within the year. So then I had 2 children.
And your child care solution then was to find people who were good with children who would come to your home and care for them?
Yes, until they were old enough, or that I felt old enough to go into daycare settings. And both children have good memories of their daycare settings where really good development went on. Yes.
So it sounds like you had some wonderful doors open to you But as a woman doing the kind of work you were doing, did you feel that you were treated fairly, so you know, equally with men in your profession?
I did, and I always have. And in sort of getting ready to think about this interview that we're going to have, I really realized that on the rare occasion, first of all, I seemed to let things run off me like water off a duck's back. But on the few occasions where there has been something noticeable, and I guess I can say it here, like I was goosed once, you know, by somebody on a job, and it was noticed by some other women, and they thought I should complain. But it was a job, this was later on, much later on, where I was working, as a matter of fact, for the Department of the Navy, on a very important thing that was dear to me, and I said, well, no, I wouldn't dream of pursuing this because that's not what my focus is. This is just nothing. My focus is to get this job done. But I don't think many things like that happen. Certainly, I have had people, particularly in the Navy setting, once or twice call me Cookie until they were sort of corrected by an admiral who might say, now, Dr. O'Keefe, what do you think of this or that? Oh, and they sort of get the message. But generally speaking, I would say that I didn't experience or feel a glass ceiling.
So then when all these changes were happening for women in the 1960s and the, what became known as the Women's Liberation Movement was underway, did you feel that that was something for that would benefit other women and that you were in good shape?
In a way, I did, but I certainly remember when the first issue of Ms. came out. I mean, I kept that issue for a long time, and as a matter of fact, I'm sorry that I still don't have it. It had, as I recall, Wonder Woman on the cover. It was a great issue. So I was very interested in it, but I didn't feel, because later when I became a civil servant, the salaries are equal. You're not, you know, fighting for salaries. I got my doctorate in 1965 while I was working on that project where Dr. Woolman had come to bring me back to Washington. So from that point on, 1965, I was kind of on my own, but armed with having a doctorate. I worked one job with a group called Planning Research Corporation, where I was the only or the first senior associate. So I had that. Once in 1973, I was sent to Harvard Business School as a mid-career opportunity that the government gave to me, and I was the only female in a group of 161 men, but I was always treated very, very well. I was treated very well. So I did look at it, but it wasn't a concern to me.
So looking back now at your emergence as a young, well-educated woman, progressing in their career and being a wonderful mother to two sons, what do you think was the most challenging aspect of your development as a woman and a professional through those years?
It's really hard to say. And I won't say that I was a wonderful mother. I mean, you'd have to ask the two boys about that. You know, I don't know. But I think I was a good enough mother because they've certainly turned out, you know, to be okay. I don't know what would be the most challenging, but I do know that I've had a career that I just feel so happy about. I've done two things, one working with Head Start, which was just a great opportunity, and the other with the Department of the Navy. With Head Start, I was able to travel all over the country working with Head Start programs, and with the Navy, all over the world working with Navy bases. And I think it would be the challenge that when I wanted to do something, how would I fit it in with the rest of my life so that nobody would be a loser, that everybody could be a winner in some way. And I honestly do believe if I would have dropped dead right now, I wouldn't have any regrets about anything like that, which is really good.
So when you think about young women...
But I do have something else. Looking for models. Matter of fact, one of my models for my behavior is a woman that you just recently interviewed, and that's Lois Dotta. You know, things that she has said. She's not that much older than I am, but we were close, and I would often listen to her. And she often had things to say that were just really meaningful. My mother, I can't tell you how my mother's advice, just in growing up with her, and my father, that just wise things to hang on to, that have stood me in good stead all of these years. One example from Lois Dotta is that we were both working for Head Start, and I, by the way, we've both been affiliated with Head Start for its entire 50-year existence, which is something I think we're both proud of. But I remember one day when I was griping just a little bit that with all the travel I was doing, there would be occasional instances for what I considered a very legitimate expense, but you couldn't list it to be reimbursed because it didn't fit the bureaucratic protocol. And I'd like to think I wasn't griping a lot, but I did mention it to Lois Ellen. And she said, well, you know, here we are at Head Start with this rubbing shoulders, working closely with the greats of the world, Edward Ziegler, Yuri Bronfenbrenner, all these people. Isn't it just wonderful? I sort of know what you're saying, but in my mind, I just think every year I have a mental little budget to cover costs like that so that I don't have to spend any energy, don't have to worry about it, and I just enjoy all the luxuries and perks of this terrific job. And I thought, oh, that's a great way to look at it. And I adopted that for the rest of my life, that I've had such wonderful jobs that what's an occasional unreimbursed, what's even a lot of unreimbursed, doesn't matter.
Right. So do you think that young women today have an easier path than you had? Is there any particular lessons to be learned from what you went through? Or?
It's really hard to say because I have a 29-year-old, very well-educated granddaughter, and I just see that the whole job market is really different. So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to say that anybody who works hard and, you know, does all the right things is going to have right things happen to them. But in many ways, I feel that just so many lucky things unfolded for me. Jobs at camps, it's really hard to say. And I try to keep in touch with this younger generation. I try to go to programs or meetings where I can listen to them and hear them. But it just seems that they have a hard time. We read about them, you know, going back to live. They can't live alone. I can't even imagine not being financially independent. I cannot even imagine that. And yet, I don't know. I think it's hard to be young today. I do.
So thank you so much, Anne, for telling us a lot about your life and your really interesting career. Any thoughts that you wanted to end with today on something that maybe we didn't touch on?
No, just that I have had these wonderful friends that I made, things that I've done, travels that I've had, the jobs, the two main ones that were just lifetime careers, helping Head Start. I'm very proud of that Head Start is still alive and thriving today. And that the Navy Family Support Program, which began in 1978, is still alive and strong. These are just how fortunate I am. I'm a lucky person, a wonderful family. I did remarry. I have had three marriages, and I was lucky in a way in all three of them. But my third one was the charm, just wonderful, and I have wonderful sons and a family. So it's a happy interview that I'm having with you. Thank you for giving me a chance to do it, Eileen.
Thank you, Anne, and I feel very fortunate and lucky myself that you're part of my family because I married your brother. So thanks and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Same to you.